News Talk Breakfast with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
In association with AIR
on News Talk.
New law reforms will place the onus on a person accused of rape to show they had an objectively reasonable belief that they had the consent of the victim. Now, to get some reaction and analysis of the plans due to be approved by Cabinet today, I'm joined by News Talk Courts reporter Frank Graney. Frank, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, what is the current situation? What is a defence in terms of consent and it being accepted by the court that someone believed there was consent when the victim is saying, no, there was not consent?
Yeah, well, as it stands, there is an honest belief defence. And the current definition is that the person knows that the other is not consenting or is reckless as to whether that person is consenting. And my understanding is that this new law will essentially change the mental element to the existing law. And when I say mental element, what I'm referring to is what was going on in the mind of the accused at the time, because that is one of the jury's essential functions, to step into somebody's shoes, take a walk around in them in the hope of trying to figure out what their intention of state of mind was at the time of the commission of an alleged offence, in this case, rape. So as I'm reading it today, the proposed change would add that legislative criteria for rape will be satisfied if at the time the person does not reasonably believe that the woman was consenting. And in order to avail of a consent defence, an accused person would have to show, as you say, an objectionable belief that they had the consent of, yeah, of the victim.
How does that come about? How can there be any objective assessment in a he says, she says situation?
Well, there you go. And that's really at the heart of it, isn't it? I mean, the devil is always in the details. So it'll be interesting to follow the debates through the House of the Oireachtas if, as expected, this proposed bill is approved by Cabinet today, when the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, brings it to, because there are a lot of issues at play here. I mean, I don't think it's reasonable just to expect somebody to essentially have a clipboard with a checkbox system by their bed in these situations. But perhaps things like, you know, I don't know, demeanour, body behaviour, words yeah. exchanged, things like that, they would all have to be outlined in great detail. You know, yeah. I think what it's about is fine tuning and maybe correcting the balance when it comes to contesting these yeah. cases.
Now, one of the reasons that the reform was sought was because the Supreme Court confirmed in 2016 that an honest, although unreasonable, mistake that the woman was consenting is a defence. In other words, you shouldn't have believed she was consenting, but it is your honest belief that she was consenting, so that is a defence. It doesn't necessarily mean an acquittal, by the way, but yeah. You know, it's a defence that you can offer, and that would be taken away if, for example, there was some evidence, and I don't know how this would actually be produced or realised, that there was no consent.
Yeah, and that decision by the Supreme Court that you've referenced there was remarkable. That was in 2016. And about 3 years later, then we had the Law Reform Commission in 2019 recommending getting rid of that honest belief defence. And that's possibly why. And I know I have seen, you know, organisations criticising that honest belief defence and arguing that that's why there is such a low level when it comes to convictions and to bringing cases in the first place, because long before it comes before a jury, the Director of Public Prosecutions will have to actually look at the case, look at the evidence that's going to be presented at the case, will take all of these into consideration before charges are even brought. So there's an argument out that the cases don't even come into the courthouse because potentially of that defence. So, you know, when you're talking about reasonable belief, so where this arises in a rape trial, a jury would have to take a 360 look at the person in the dock, and they'd have to ask themselves questions like, you know, is there any physical, mental or intellectual disabilities at play here? You know, did the person suffer from a mental illness, age, maturity, life experience? I'd imagine all of these things would be taken into consideration. And importantly, and it's very important to point this out, under these proposed changes, booze or drugs won't feature in that consideration, because another proposal that is being brought to Cabinet today is to remove self-induced intoxication as a defence. And that's in relation to when it comes to an accused person's ability to understand whether there was consent.
There does seem to be still, maybe it might be seen as an old-fashioned attitude now, that, you know, the woman, and there is, of course, male-on-male rapes and so on, but the woman is prey and the male is predator, because often when intoxicated sex happens, both parties are intoxicated, to the point sometimes of memory loss.
Yes, and look, in most of the cases that I have covered before the Central Criminal Court, you know, 9 times out of 10, alcohol features in some shape or form. And I read a statistic recently where I think it was, you know, something as high as 80% of these cases, there was binge drinking involved. And clearly when binge drinking is involved, you have blackouts, you have errors in judgment, you have fragmented memories. And that's why these cases, I think, are so difficult to successfully prosecute and to run in the first instance, because, you know, it is often the case of he says, she says, or as you say, potentially he says, you know, and that is the difficulty for a jury. And their job is made even more difficult when booze is involved and people don't remember things because of the amount of booze they have taken. But so that was an interesting proposal. And I was looking at this today, the fact that self-induced intoxication will no longer be a defence if these proposals go all the way, go the distance. And again, that comes to an accused person's ability to understand whether there was consent. So that defence would no longer be available to them under these proposals. And that is a very interesting development.
Yeah. Now, other things that may be included in this law, I know you've said already that the devil is in the detail. And of course, case law will develop as cases are processed through the courts. But anonymity for victims and the accused in all trials for sexual offences and not just in rape trials. In other words, there may be a heinous rape or a heinous sexual assault committed, but the accused will benefit from anonymity until they are found guilty, one presumes. And even then, the anonymity might prevail to protect the victim. But that is probably progression in the sense that someone who is acquitted can often emerge from a courtroom with their life ruined.
And that's precisely it. So as it stands, that, you know, protection isn't afforded to people when it comes to cases of sexual assault. As you say, it is only reserved in cases where there is rape. So one of the proposed changes will be to change that. And I think that is a welcome development because, you know, people do say that, you know, to be accused of a sex crime is worse than being accused of murder, because even if you're acquitted of that sex crime, there is always that sniff of guilt. There is always that shadow lurking and behind you. You know, you could walk out of the courtroom having been acquitted, but the fact that you've been accused is taboo in itself. Yeah. So I think that is a welcome change. The public gallery as well will be closed for these offences. As it stands, it's just rape. And this is all coming on the back of an expert group who made a number of recommendations. This was chaired by Tom O'Malley in the wake of the Belfast rape trial, which we obviously covered extensively on the show 4 years ago. And it would also introduce things like pre-trial hearings in these types of trials. And that would save an awful lot of time for starters when it comes to legal argument. And also, you know, in cases where the defence wants to call evidence in relation to a complainant's previous sexual history, that won't be thrashed out in the middle of a trial. That will all be settled before a jury is even sworn in.
And the right of someone to have legal representation, if this is in the case of a victim, to have legal representation in the event of the prosecution or defence, and presumably it's the defence by and large, who want to question that person about their sexual history, they will have legal representation to protect them during that process.
Yeah, so as it stands, a complainant does have that legal representation when that application or if that application is brought by the defence. They don't have an automatic right to question, cross-examine a complainant in relation to their previous sexual history. They have to ask the permission of the court. And at that point, when that application is made, the jury is excused and the legal argument takes place in their absence. And the state is represented by a barrister on behalf of the Director of Public Prosecutions. An accused person is obviously represented. And also at that point, the complainant is represented, because I think a lot of people don't realise that when these cases are brought, they're not brought by the complainant making the allegations. They're brought by a representative for the state.
The complainant is simply a witness in their own case. Now, but they're going to, the change, I suppose, is that they're going to extend this right to legal representation in not just in rape, but in sexual assault cases.
Correct. And again, I think that's to be welcome too.
The final thing is about social media, because, you know, the definitions of broadcast and publication currently would apply to print and broadcast media of the traditional kind. But of course, we've had identification of people in court on social media. So the rules are going to change to make sure that anyone trying to reveal something about a case cannot now do so. Or if they do, they face the full sanction of the law.
Absolutely. And again, just to illustrate the point, I'll throw back to that case that we covered daily, the Belfast rape trial back in 2018, where that was an issue. You know, I know there are differences in the rules and how these cases are run north of the border, but the complainant in Belfast would have been entitled to the same anonymity that a complainant in a court in Dublin is. But, you know, a lot of people were posting information about this person online. And what they're going to do now in Ireland, if these proposed changes go through and again go the distance, that the definition of broadcast and publication, as you say, those traditional words that are in the legislation, will be updated to ensure that social media is covered in order to protect the victim's identity. That's very interesting. I do remember a former Chief Justice, Frank Clark, made a direction that members in the public gallery in any criminal case are not allowed to use social media to, for example, live tweet about a case, that would be reserved for genuine and bona fide journalists. But that now puts it in legislation, puts any doubt at bay. But you have to remember as well that during these types of cases, certainly in rape cases at the moment, the public gallery is closed. So it's not really an issue there. And again, if these proposed changes are accepted, that would extend again to cases of sexual assault.
Now, we want to turn briefly to another story, Frank, and it's a fascinating story. It would appear from academic research that went on over 5 years, Massachusetts Institute of Technology were involved in it, looking at court judgments, and particularly the High Court, not so much in the Appeal Court or the Supreme Court, but in the High Court, that judges or the judgments, whoever wrote them, I presume the judges did, were citing Wikipedia and quoting precedents that had been, you know, deliberately placed there by these researchers more than other precedents that had not been placed there in citing precedent law.
This is a remarkable case. And when your producer, Mike, flagged this with me this morning, I honestly thought he was taking the mick out of me, you know. And I looked at some of the articles online. Mary Carolyn, the Irish Times, is writing about it today. She's a rock star in the world of legal journalism. This is a remarkable story, you know. And the key finding of it, as you say, is that getting a Wikipedia article increased a case's citation by more than 20%. Well, what does that mean? It suggests, according to that article, according to that research, that Wikipedia is used more by judges or legal assistants when they have a heavy workload, for whom obviously the convenience of an online tool like that is a greater attraction. The worry is that obviously, given the nature of Wikipedia and the fact that these pages, as I understand it, can be edited, you know, that the information might be reliable, that if that is the case, that if judges, and I have nothing to suggest that they are relying on this information, by the way, but if they are, you know, and if they are relying on unreliable information, then that is a real worry. I mean, Wikipedia is useful.
By the way, it's not just a suspicion, because these researchers showed that they actually used phrases directly copied from the citations written in Wikipedia, which they couldn't have just come up randomly, coincidentally, from their own brains.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, it's hard to know how much it influences a judge's decision. You know, judgments, in my experience, are always very lengthy, considered, extremely detailed. So there should be no doubt as to how a judge or judges arrived at a decision. I've certainly never heard of Wikipedia being referenced in a judgment of the court. You would hope that it's looked at only if it is looked at. And, you know, that article and that research suggests that it is, that it's only been looked at as a starting point and not the finish line, because there is a danger of malicious editing to advance one's case in a case of litigation. I don't really buy that. I don't know if that's happening, but judges are smart and they're very good at sniffing, you know, BS out. So you would hope that they are using this as perhaps, again, as I say, a starting point, yeah, but not a landing zone as such.
Well, at the one of the co-authors of the report had this to say, our work shows that Wikipedia reaches even farther into high-stakes formalized processes like legal judgments. The worst outcome would be for a judge's reliance on Wikipedia to lead them to decide a case differently than they would have done if they had read either an expert secondary source or the cited precedent itself, rather than simply a Wikipedia article. Even without any difference in outcome, however, judges' reliance on Wikipedia to determine the applicable law undermines the litigant's expectation that the court's reasoning is the product of expertise alone and not Googling Wikipedia.
That's the worry, isn't it? I mean, like, as I say, Wikipedia is a useful reference tool. I use it from time to time myself, but I would never rely on it. It should be taken with a pinch of salt. Yeah. I mean, you often have cases where newspaper articles in relation to previous court cases are handed up to a judge to advance arguments where case law is relevant, but they certainly don't rely on those. They would do their due diligence. Yeah. I mean,
that's the point.
Wikipedia
is a signpost that might help you along the way.
Precisely, yes. I would be very surprised if judges were relying on it exclusively when they're making their decisions.
Frank Rainey, News Talk's courts correspondent, thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.